Hey there, it's the No Komodo Podcast episode number 42. We had kind of an overcast day, so not really one of our 300 days of sunshine. We got a little cheated here in northern Colorado today. And at the beginning of this, I'm going to remind everyone, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a review on iTunes or your listening method of choice. Your portal, is that what people say? Your portal now or whatever? Whatever. And send us emails to nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. I'm your host, MotoG Pete. With me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yo.
Let's talk bikes. All right, let's jump right into best worst bike in the world this week. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right. If you're a new listener to the show, here's the rundown. Every week, me and Swiggy, we each pick a different bike, alternating between us. We choose these as the best and worst bike in the world this week. If you disagree, don't get your feelings hurt, because next week there'll be a new one. It's only the best and worst bike in the world for 1 week. And as Liza famously said, there's no crying in motorcycles, so we don't want to hear it. Having said that, let's move on here. So you've got best bike in the world this week.
No.
Oh, no, you have worst. Okay. See, I think a lot of people wonder why I'm always going like, okay, so do you have best worst? I honestly can never remember, even though I've prepared one myself. It's so dumb. Okay, so you have worst bike in the world this week. You ready to reveal that?
Yep.
Okay, and the worst bike in the world this week is?
The Ducati Monster 620IE.
Ooh. That's a shocking one, because we did the Ducati Monster as the best bike in the world at one point.
Well, the 696 is excellent.
Okay.
This one, not so much.
All right. So I'm not aware of the problems with this, so I'm going to sit back and let you teach me something.
Okay. So this bike was released in 2002, and they stopped making it in 2003. It is significantly smaller than the other Monsters. This is almost like a little bit smaller than a CBR 500R. And the thing about this bike is that nothing really makes sense on it.
Okay.
So if you were to compare this bike to, say, a 2002 SV650, the SV650 is cheaper, and it blows it away in every category except for not having the Ducati badge.
Really?
Okay. So, this bike is a weird combination of trying to be an early Ducati budget bike,
mm-hmm.
while also trying to meet emissions and do a few other things. So, this bike was around $7,000 in 2002.
And this is not the first version. This is the second version?
This is a shrunk down version. So this is like a smaller.
Oh, okay. So after they had the Monster out for a while, they're like, oh, let's do a baby Monster.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's got 60 horsepower. It's about 40 foot-pounds of torque. But this is a small displacement L-twin that does 9,500 RPM.
Well, okay, the 9,500 RPM sounds about right. What's really confusing me here is,
but it's a 9,500 RPM L-twin 2-valve.
Right. No, but here's my problem. So the whole advantage of the L-twin is you get to make a long stroker close to square, slightly long stroker close to square twin, so you make a respectable amount of power and big torque. This has 600 sport bike torque, and it really should be making more like high 40s, low 50s.
Perhaps, but
I mean, if I was designing a 650 sort of range, you know, then that's where I would end up with, a little bit north of 40 foot-pounds of torque.
Right. But this is This is ninja
levels. I say that like I've ever designed an engine, right?
Right. But, yeah. But this is also like ninja, like inline four levels of
short stroke.
Of short stroke. And it's 10.7:1 compression. So it is also fuel injected, but it's air cooled. So when you kind of put this all together, this is, I think they kind of just threw throttle body injection on it at the last second for emissions. But this is aiming to be a small displacement, pass emissions, and try and get some power out of it.
Right. But they easily could have gotten away with 50 horsepower and boosted up the torque. And then you'd really feel that V-twin sort of thing out of it. And you'd be like, yeah, okay, I'm not making 100 horsepower. Mm-hmm. I'm not even making 60 horsepower. But, you know, 50 horsepower is enough to get you up to 90-something, 100 miles an hour. But it's not going to be all that much fun doing it. You're not going to feel that Ducati, you know, torquiness. You're not going
to. I mean, it is still some pretty good torque, but it's when you compare it to other things in the category, it's like, is this all we get?
Right.
So the only like really flashy thing this bike has is it has dual front discs with four piston calipers, which is kind of overkill for the kind of power and this bike has and the weight it is, which is around like 430 pounds.
Right, but you need something to make the bike sort of present when you're trying to hang out with the rest of the Ducatisti.
Right. Now if you compare this to the SV650 from the same year, which is also a 90 degree twin that's with double overhead cams, four valves per cylinder, actually a little bit less over square, liquid cooled, 11.5:1 compression with 72 horsepower at 9,000 RPM and 47 foot-pounds of torque and over $1,000 cheaper new. This bike really starts to not make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, the whole thing about Ducati and what the brand kind of represents is, although there are some budget bikes in there, they don't make a lot of bikes a year. You know, they make about, what is it, 40,000 a year? Something like that?
If even, yeah.
Right. So, and you're always going to expect to pay a bit more for a Ducati over any big four bike. But you're getting a level of, you know, there's a level of passion involved in this weird Italian flavor to it. And you know it's not going to be the most reliable. And it's not going to be the cheapest. And it's not going to be cheap to maintain. And it may have electrical gremlins. It may be a little temperamental.
They've gotten so much better, though.
They have. But you're expecting to get, there's some elements you're expecting to get out of this bike that you're going to pay that premium for. But really, all this bike has compared to the competition is the badge.
Yes.
And if that's all you have, then that starts to just devalue the whole brand. Now, not only is this more expensive than an SV650, it's still a Ducati. It's still Desmo valves. You're still paying Ducati maintenance prices.
I could be completely wrong, and someone may just decide to have to send in an angry email and school me on this, but I believe this is still like a Panta engine as well. This isn't, you know, like Testastretta or whatever other sort of generation of engine. This is kind of like how Harley Davidson still puts the Evo motor in the Sportsters, right? It's not like the last generation of engine. It's from, you know, the 80s, essentially. It's a couple generations ago.
Right. I'm not sure.
So, yeah, I believe this is an older motor, this air-cooled Panta, or some version of the Panta engine, which was Ducati's bread and butter for a long time in its day. Great motor. But I don't know if it's that great. Like, this engine has a lot more to do with the Ducati Indiana than it does the Panigale.
Right.
Yeah. So that might explain some of the lower performance, and, you know, maybe this engine just never had expectations to make that kind of power built with those kinds of tolerances and compression and all those things that, you know, really let you squeeze out the most amount of power possible. You know, that slightly lower red line with the short stroke, it should be able to rev a little bit higher, but yeah, I don't know.
But again, you know, when you put it all together and think about what kind of, maybe think about what skill level rider, what kind of financial position you're in, what the size of bike is for, who ticks off all the boxes that makes this their ideal bike? It's nobody.
Yeah, it must have just been that the Ducati Monster was such a big hit, and there were some people that were still priced out of it. You know, part of the genius of the Monster when it first came out was it was a Ducati that was affordable, and it had this cool factor to it, but it still wasn't a bargain bike.
Right.
It was still something desirable and, you know, you would want to aspire to, but it was very easy to then aspire to it.
Right.
So this thing coming in at that $7,000 price, then you're right. It's the devaluing. It kind of cheapens the whole brand a little too much. And the Scrambler is what's doing that these days for them. Although that's such a big, I mean, I'm sure Scrambler sales make up the vast majority of the profit they're making overall. They must sell three of those for every Panigale that they sell, I'm sure. Yeah. So the question is, I mean, well, no, there is no question. Like you said, they brought this out in 2002, and at the end of 2003, they went, no mas, we're done with this experiment. You know, Ducati doesn't come out with a lot of models very quickly. And how many bikes would they have had even in their lineup at this time, right?
Right.
The 999, they would have had the SS800 and 900. They would have had the Multistrada.
I think this was pre-Diavel.
Oh, yeah. Not a whole lot of stuff in the lineup. And Ducati doesn't change their lineup as quickly or as often as a lot of other companies. It's only been very recently they've run with a much wider range of bikes.
Mm-hmm.
So Ducati didn't even really give this enough time to catch on, perhaps. They just realized it wasn't that great, then killed it that quickly. And I don't know. I don't think Ducati has much of a history of running bikes only for just a couple years, except for the Indiana, right?
Right.
So this, they obviously themselves even realized how quick it was. And Ducati is kind of a company that, you know, really thinks carefully before they put a bike out. So this must have been some sort of like snap decision. I'm guessing this must have been like, you know, the Monster saved the company, but at this time, maybe they were looking to be acquired. This must have been like during one of those times there were meetings of like, is someone going to have to buy the company from us? Are we going to have to do this, do that?
We got to fill out our portfolio.
Exactly. And maybe we just, you know, a boardroom decision came down that we've got to have the absolute cheapest thing we can.
It's like, no, you can't design a new motor.
Right. Yeah. What can we do? We've still got some Pantas lying around. Let's put, you know, let's do that. Like, well, I mean, the Monster always had like a Panta in the beginning. But it's, yeah, that's the only way that this makes sense. And it still doesn't make sense for the consumer. And yet it's hard to hate on it because it's a Ducati Monster and everyone loves a Ducati Monster. But when you realize that an SV650 is more powerful, yeah. And then this is going to carry
more powerful and more torque.
Right.
And it's still carbureted.
Is the current SV650 carbureted?
No, the 2002 one.
Oh, yeah, that was. Exactly. So, yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I never thought I would dislike a Monster. Oh, this is upside down world. I don't know how to feel about this.
I know.
Oh, how did I never realize this? You'd never hear about the 620, but again, it was just for like 2 years. Wow. What does the IE stand for?
I can't remember exactly. There were two models. There was an IE, was like the standard one, and then there was a more upmarket one that came with some like a lighter frame and swing arm, like a titanium swing arm or something that dropped a bunch of weight.
Dang it. This saddens me. I don't want to hate on a Ducati Monster, but the value proposition is crappy. If Suzuki was just destroying them, because Suzuki definitely has some great value bikes, but they're, like I said a couple episodes ago, like the GSX-R series quietly has become a much more premium bike, where it's retained this reputation of being the best bang for buck horsepower street bike. But Suzuki updates the GSX-R series like crazy.
Every 2 years.
Yeah, it's where all their development goes, and things like the SV just sort of stay the same forever, or the TU250, or, you know, Suzuki's definitely equipped the most carburetors to bikes out of all the large OEMs, you know, in this millennium.
Well, after the KLR, I think the longest running still carbureted motorcycle is probably the TW200, which I think they've been making since 86.
Is there a 200 and a 250?
No, there's a TU250.
Oh, right. Sorry.
And then
there's
the TW200.
Right, which is a great little bike.
But I think it's now, I think it is, it may be one of the longest running bikes that's still being made after the KLR is retired.
Yeah, we're going to have to look into that. I bet you're right. It's got to be over 20 years, minimum.
Oh, it's at least 30.
You think it's that much?
They were making it in the 80s. But anyways.
Yeah, well, we digress. All right, so, yeah, basically, this is a Ducati Monster that the SV650 crowd will make fun of you for. And, you know, the SV650 crowd is a cult, and that's a great bike, and I'm not even going to begin to hate on, but it's not known as a super powerful bike. And if you're going to get your ass kicked at stoplights by something that costs $1,000 more, and if you just for that with inflation, I'm sure that equates to almost $2,000 more in today's money.
It's like $1,400, something okay. Like that.
Right. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And yeah, you're not track competitive. You're not street competitive. You're really just kind of a poser on this one in a strange way. And that's really strange because it's a real Ducati. Oh, man. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. Ducati cannot do the budget bike thing without having a twist to it. You know, the Ducati Scrambler makes a ton of sense because they're changing the game. They're changing what the bike is, the expectations of what the bike can do. And they threw in like the old 70s styling that they had on the singles with the tank and the seat. And they kind of put all that together. And then it was a cool new thing. But
right.
You can't just take a monster or a super sport and just shrink it down and say, oh, well, this is a monster that goes slower and has less torque. And it's a bit cheaper. You can't scale down.
Right. And you still can't, and it would even make sense if it was designed to be that way, but you could still, you know, it was designed to fit within the A2 license bracket, but this doesn't do that either.
Right.
So it'd be one thing if they made an A2 license monster that was an absolute class killer and was therefore another $1,000 more expensive. That would make complete sense. But this doesn't.
Right.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's just mediocre. It's a Ducati that's just mediocre in every way. And that's the one thing a Ducati can't be. A Ducati can be finicky. You know, it can have, quotes, personality, you know, through its faults, right? A Ducati can even be sort of ugly as long as it has panache, right? And a Ducati can be too expensive. And a Ducati doesn't have to have the most horsepower. Traditionally, they never really have. But it does have to be competitive, at least in acceleration, and have some sort of track application. And this doesn't. This is just mediocre. It's just, it doesn't stack up anywhere on the performance. And it doesn't stack up anywhere on the styling, because it's just a copy of the already existing Monster, which is great. So every time you're riding this, you just be reminded that you're not on the good one.
Right. You know what this reminds me of? Well, this is kind of, it's not the same thing because it is still made by Ducati, but it's kind of like when Dad got that air compressor that has said Kawasaki across it. And we're like, oh, giant Kawasaki air compressor. This is going to be great. And then we find out, oh, it's actually a Chinese knockoff that's bought the rights to write Kawasaki across it. And overall, that just hurts Kawasaki more than it could possibly help them. You know, it's that sort of thing. Or like when Snap-on starts branding like Chinese stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why? Because this stuff is like, when you've gone for like bargain bin Chinese like goods, and then you start putting this like highly prestigious name on it, it's, well, you're probably hurting your brand more. And this is almost in the same category where as soon as you try and sell it on the brand, you're devaluing the brand. And that's kind of what I feel like this bike is guilty of.
Yeah, and it's the brand is the only thing it's being sold on. Ugh. Okay, we got to move on. It's depressing me. I can't look at it anymore. Ugh.
All right, let's move on.
Okay. All right, now we're going to move on to something pretty exciting. We're going to do the best bike in the world this week. And the best bike in the world is the 1958 to 1965 Ariel Leader. Now, I've been going on a lot about old British bikes and bikes that I think are sort of some of the front runners in being guilty for killing the British bike industry. And this is one of those bikes that gets that blame, but it is completely undeserved. In the late 50s, mid 60s, this British motorcycle was swimming against the current real hard. And if only there'd been a little bit more enthusiasm, this is the kind of bike that could have saved the British bike industry. And in fact, I blame Americans for ruining Ariel and for the failure ultimately of this motorcycle. And we're going to have to get some historical context for those statements to make sense. So, little brush up on Ariel here. Ariel, you know, was making bicycles and all that sort of stuff. All the early history of all the early motorcycle companies applies, right? Now, Ariel really sort of hit it big when they were making motorcycles for World War II. Ariel was one of the largest motorcycle manufacturers before World War II. Right behind BSA, I think, who was the largest. And Ariel really kind of made its name during World War II, making motorcycles for the war. And they were wonderful bikes. And they were even kind of specced down versions of the bikes they'd been making before the war. And I'm not going to go into all those different makes and every, not different makes, different models, but essentially they come out of World War II with a huge amount of pride. You know, they've been putting out all these adverts about how, like, you know, we're on top of the job making bikes for the war. And so it was very patriotic sort of to have an Ariel, but they were also very, very good bikes, especially the Red Hunter. And of course, they made the Square 4 around that time and everything. And, you know, they were great bikes. Now, there was a slow decline in sales over time, like there was for a lot of these companies. And, you know, I mean, this, for example, this bike came out right about the time the Japanese were really just showing up to the Isle of Man for the first time. Right.
Right.
I'm sorry. No, just a few years after that.
Okay.
So I think the Japanese started showing up to Isle of Man in the early 50s. Maybe like 51, 52 Honda went, something like that. I seem to recall. Might have been 53 or 54. This comes out in 58. So the British motorcycle industry isn't really feeling a lot of super heavy heat from the Japanese just quite yet. I mean, maybe it's starting to turn up a little bit, but it's not really a big concern yet. There are some Japanese bikes around, and, you know, it's still a period where a lot of people wouldn't be caught dead on a Japanese bike and all that sort of stuff. Honda isn't even in California yet. And then we get the Aerial Leader, and this is a radically different motorcycle than they'd ever created before. And if you kind of think about the Velocet LE and all that other stuff, well, this makes sense. We've got not leading link, but trailing link front suspension, which is supposed to work very well for the time. It's a 252 stroke. I think we're talking something around 16 horsepower. Top speed of about 65. Perfectly usable for the time, for the roads, for the traffic speeds. It was not considered slow. But what you have is a very radical departure from the standard British bike look. The headlight and the top half of the fairing almost looks like the KZ-1000s from Chips in a really strange way, with this bubble windshield that comes up really high, and that was standard, I believe. And then it's got leg shields that come all the way down. Then you got fairly standard controls. It had an option to be bought with built-in pannier boxes and a top box for the back. The thing that looks like a tank, that's a completely faux tank. You could fit a whole helmet in there, or at least a half helmet from the time.
Okay.
So it was well above its time for being a practical sort of motorcycle. And this is really about that time where the sort of like mods and rockers split was going on in British motorcycle culture. You know, the rockers were staying with their Triumphs and all that other stuff and just really digging in. And then the mods were on their scooters and other kinds of bikes and all that kind of stuff. And this landed somewhere right in the middle where it's very British. Very, very, very British. But it doesn't look like an old British bike. And it had a lot of like nice little features and amenities. Like there was a clock on it and, you know, stuff that wasn't expected. And, you know, you attack and your speedo, you're just a full set of gauges. This really had almost like a dashboard, you know?
Right.
And so the guy that designed this is a bit of a legend in British motorcycle design. His name was Val Page. Val Page was an engineer and helped design not completely himself designed the engines in the Brough Superior SS100. And he did some work with Vincent as well. And most of his career, he worked with Aerial. He basically came up with the bike that turned into the Red Hunter, which is, you know, just an absolute British classic pre-war. And this guy's career is amazing. And this is kind of one of the last things he did, was come up with this bike. And here's the odd thing. This is kind of like the Velocet LE in that it was designed to be, you know, fairly quiet, easy to use, practical, economical. And, you know, it had the leg shields and stuff. This wasn't a biker's bike. This was sort of a professional's motorcycle. It was much more respectable to be on one of these. And it was designed to hit a new market and be a new kind of motorcycle. And it really was something totally new and a bold, great direction. And some and not very many people in the British motorcycle industry were trying to do something different around this time, even when the Japanese stuff came around and Harley started, you know, really becoming Harley in the 70s. A lot of British makes just doubled down and were like, no, we're just going to be even more British than we were before. And the Aerial Leader was completely different. But what's the problem? The problem is James Dean. Americans didn't want to buy this motorcycle because it didn't look like an old British bike, even though it was just as good or better in many ways. Brits loved this motorcycle. If you were a sort of a young professional and you had a little bit of means, this was your motorcycle. You could go to work in your suit and take your briefcase and all your stuff and everything and go to work and be perfectly good on this motorcycle. You didn't have to have a car. You know, it's kind of, you know, it kind of fits into that culture where the Mini fits into British culture.
Right.
It wasn't meant to be the be-all and end-all greatest vehicle of all time. It was cheap, cheerful, but also exceptionally stylish. And there, you think when you first look at it, there's something very sort of 50s space age about the look. But if you take a closer look and you imagine a girl sitting on one with like a go-go dress and polka dots and everything, you realize it actually has this very progressive late 60s swinging London sort of mod look to it.
Yeah.
It's very like if Austin Powers rode a motorcycle, this is the motorcycle. And once you look at it in that way, with the two-tone colors, because again, so many motorcycles were still just black at this time. In fact, one of Ariel's trademarks was before World War II, you could buy the Red Hunter with a red tank when like everything else was just black, right? Motorcycles were just black for a long time. And Ariel sort of broke that mold. And then this being available with the full bodywork and it being two-tone and everything, it was wild. People didn't expect that. Everything about this motorcycle did something very, very different.
I'm almost expecting to see an ashtray on this.
Right? And, you know, from the two-stroke twin to the encased headlight, the standard windshield, the leg guards, the trailing link suspension, the faux tank glove box, the incorporated luggage option, the easy controls, the extra gauges and display on the dash. Everything about this was unexpected and a vast change and really a nice breath of fresh air that almost could have saved the British motorcycle industry. But after it didn't sell in America, it was cut short. And Ariel decided to stop this and then go a more traditional direction afterwards, eventually leading to their decline. And then they did have a second stab at it. I'll give them credit for that, which was the Ariel Aero, which is a truly horrific looking motorcycle. The Ariel Aero is the same motorcycle. They just took all the bodywork off. But they still left this weird. Now, this has a Presteel frame, and it has a Presteel frame because it didn't need to be a performance motorcycle. They moved the gas tank under the seat. It could fit inside the frame, but the Presteel frame was very cheap to make because this was supposed to be a very affordable motorcycle. But they kept that frame in the Ariel Aero, which is bizarre.
Yeah.
So you've got this square frame bike with no other bodywork and a very awkward looking engine underneath it. And then the tank part of the body really stops making sense when it doesn't have the fairing and the headlight housing to connect to. But they thought, well, maybe people will buy this motorcycle in America if we try to make it look a little bit more classic British. And it just ended up looking really awkward. And it wasn't very fast on top of that. So, of course, Americans wanted that even less. Because about the time they make the Ariel Aero, people are like, well, if I'm not interested in going fast, well, why wouldn't I just get, like, you know, a Honda Super Cub?
Right.
But there was already this predating it, which is better than a Honda Super Cub. Like I said, this is the best bike in the world because it almost could have saved the British motorcycle industry when everybody else in British motorcycles was doing the same old thing. Val Page is a visionary who just made amazing motorcycle after amazing motorcycle, went this bold direction and tried something new, and Brits loved it. But the tide was already so bad, like it just got sucked back into the vortex of bad ideas that was the bike culture or the manufacturing culture.
Yeah. I think Emma was saying like bikes were being sold in California like 3-1 versus the entirety of Britain.
Apparently it was more like 6-1.
Oh, really? Right. Yeah. So it almost, it kind of got, to, I guess it's kind of the point now around that time that, it's kind of sad to say, but there couldn't really just be a bunch of British bikes anymore, and that they all just have to satisfy the American market.
Yes.
So you couldn't have like a just for Brits. Well, you could have a just for Brits bike, but you couldn't have a just for Brits brand.
Right.
There just wasn't the market for it anymore.
Well, and Ariel tried to make this a bit of the flagship as well, and there was no way they were going to have sort of a flagship. I mean, the Square 4 was still kind of the flagship, but this was like the new hottest and latest and greatest, and there was no way they weren't going to try to press it large in America as well.
Right.
And just promptly no one bought it. I mean, if anyone has one of these registered in the States, that is rare. So... but again, if you think about all the crazy things and weird things about this motorcycle that set it apart, this was doing exactly the kind of innovative, new, weird stuff that the whole British bike market needed. But it couldn't single-handedly save. But this was the way out. And no one ignored, and everyone just sort of, you know, just forgot about it. And that's really sad because it was holding up the torch. Like, here we go. We can do different things. People will buy it. People will like it. But they went, nah, let's just go back to being stubborn. And that's really sad. But think about what other motorcycle satisfied highway speed, comfort, ease of use, reliability, innovative technology, storage, and bold style like this at that time. I can't think of anything that and the price satisfies all those needs at once when nothing else was doing it anywhere. Absolutely amazing. And like I said, if you think it's an ugly motorcycle at first, imagine Austin Powers or, you know, a go-go dancing 60s swinging London girl sitting on one, and then you'll understand what the styling really is all about. And if you look at it that way, it's actually, I think, a very funky, cool-looking bike.
Yeah, I can see where it has its place.
Oh, also, in ease of use, because it has this full bodywork, it got away with a really rare trick. A fully enclosed self-oil chain system. There's no exposed chain on this. It's all enclosed in its own oil bath.
Oh, so you don't have to worry about oil getting wicked up the inside of the wheel, and you don't have to constantly replace it?
You don't have to service the you hardly ever have to service the chain.
Ooh.
Because it's always in oil. Yeah.
I wouldn't mind something like that coming back.
It's just very hard to do it without it looking awful is the only reason. But technically, this is the most superior form of final drive ever, a fully enclosed chain system. It's just a really hard trick to pull off.
Okay.
But this bike did. So there we go. Anything else to add to that?
I don't know. It kind of... the whole styling angle is kind of got this whole, it's got this whole kind of almost a mix between the philosophies of the Super Cub, the Dream, and to an extent, a much better execution of the Naughty Bike.
Yes. Exactly.
It's kind of all of those elements pulled into one, into something that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, Brits actually loved it. It's just that no one else did. So they couldn't get the sales numbers out of it that they were getting out of, you know, selling Bonnevilles in America, for example.
Right.
It's Americans really killed it on this one. Just not being willing to go and try out something like this. Because they all Americans just wanted to be James Dean. And to a large extent, sadly, still do. Which is something we might talk about in the next segment that we do here. So, yeah, let's take a little break here. Best bike in the world, the Aerial Leader. Bet you didn't see one of those today. And we're back, and now we are going to talk about a new motorcycle, sort of. So Kawasaki has brought back the W800 to not a whole lot of fanfare, it seems. But that's weird because there was a very small and passionate crowd of people around this motorcycle hoping it would be sold in the United States, and they would bring back just the regular old W800 and life would be good. And it's being brought back in a very curious way. So if you don't know, I think you're the best one to take this for many reasons, Swiggy. Tell us about the W650 and the W800 and the history there.
So the W650 came back or was started in 99. I believe it came out just before the new Bonnevilles came out.
Yes.
And it's a lot of people will mistake a W650 for a Bonneville. But in reality, the W650 is a callback to the W1, which is actually the 60s kind of Kawasaki knockoff or the bike that Kawasaki had purchased the rights to, which was essentially a copy of the BSA A7. In a lot of ways, people still prefer the W650 and the W800 to the Bonnevilles of the same time period. Now, and even a lot of people like the W650 over the W800, but they started with the W650. They bumped it up to the W800, which was actually like 90 cc's more at most, and kind of the same power. And then over time, I think around 2008, they had the W800, and then they switched it from carbureted to fuel injection, and then eventually they just had to kill it off because it just couldn't meet emissions anymore. So now Kawasaki has brought back a W800. It appears to be even less horsepower than the original W650 at around 47, whereas my W650 is around 50 horsepower. But they've kind of given it's looking a little bit sharper, and they've added a bit more styling and flair to it. And I kind of put the level of styling and detail and fit and finish around kind of the same as like the Moto Guzzi V7. Not in terms of actual styling, but like the level of color and fit and finish and styling that they've added on to the classic look.
Yeah, so I think the reason that the W800 was very popular in like Australia and a few other places where they sold it, where they were able to sort of get away with it for emissions reasons and whatever for longer than other places, is it's a little quirky with the bevel drive on the engine. And as you said, it kind of looks more like an old Triumph than a Triumph, or even more like an old Triumph than an old Triumph, right?
Right.
It's so crazy throwback. But these are really solid, reliable bikes. And they have that cult following because of that. If you want something that is going to pretty much start every time and you want that throwback feel, well, this really is the bike. And it has similar power to those old bikes. It's a little bit better. But, yeah. Now, this new one doesn't have the kickstart, which was just a really insane just throwback thing from the put on a bike made in 2000 to 2006 or 2008, whatever.
If you're willing to make a 450-pound classic double cradle frame bike with a single front disc, two-piston caliper, and a rear drum...
Dual rear shock.
Oh, yeah. Oh no, they did put a rear disc on it.
Oh, they do. Okay, cool.
Okay, that's
improvement.
That's progress. But if you're willing to put a single front disc on a 450-pound bike with a two-piston caliper, you can put the Kickstarter on it.
Yeah. Now, here's my thing about this bike. I can't really remark on the way it looks because the street version at least looks almost identical to the old one. It's just a fuel injected W800. Now, what's really confusing me is that it appears to make less power than the old carbureted W800.
Even less than the W650.
Right. So I can only assume that they basically just took the old motor, because the motor looks pretty much identical, except like the cover on the bevel drive's a little bit different and it has fuel injection instead of carburetors.
Yeah.
But otherwise, this bike and the rear disc.
Well, the last of the old ones were fuel injected.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that. All right, so they've just basically brought back the W800 for whatever reason. They've just decided this is a time that Kawasaki can sell its most ultimate throwback bike. Now, Kawasaki around 2000 was doing a lot of throwback stuff. They were making Vulcans that just looked like old Indian Chiefs, for example. So the old Kawasaki Vulcan Drifters, kind of weirdly becoming collectible and strange now. And, you know, the W650s have really held some nice value because of that as well. The same sort of thing, just rather than doing an old American thing, they were doing an old British thing, essentially. But if you're in the market for this kind of bike right now, this is the best looking, most throwback one, without a doubt, without question. But for 47 horsepower at $10,000... I feel like there are better ways to spend your money.
Yeah. But I there's kind of a resurgence here, and I wonder if there's a few of these bikes that are kind of like second boom bikes, where you kind of think about, you know, what all the crazy shit that was being made in the mid-2000s right before the recession. You know, there were a lot, and especially around 2000, there were a lot of these throwback bikes. And they were kind of fitting into this market of, well, there were a lot of baby boomers. They grew up riding bikes. They were immersed in the biker culture. But then they all got jobs and had to put on suits and ties and sell their bikes and buy houses and get babysitters and, you know, all, you know. They got their 401ks and kind of settled into that middle-class lifestyle. And then their kids have finished college.
Yeah.
And they've got some money lying around. They've got a whole bunch of disposable income now. And what are all these FZRs and R6s and GSXRs? Like, these aren't the bikes I grew up with. So like they're kind of, there was this market opened up with all these people being able to start spending, you know, kind of their early retirement, or, you know, having all that extra income.
Well, Kawasaki was definitely cashing in on that, but nobody else really was besides Triumph that I'm aware of. Pre sort of 2008, I don't know about too many of these retro bikes. I mean, Kawasaki also did that Eddie Lawson throwback one. Mm-hmm. So Kawasaki's been at this game for some time, but now everybody has some of these bikes, and they're just keep getting, you know, their new retro bikes coming out. And I spent all day today just flabbergasted by this. And, you know, and the bike's fine, you know, $10,000. It's not really breaking the bank too bad, but it's still a lot of money for 47 horsepower. But whatever, if this is, it's still going to, you know, it doesn't need to go on the highway and doesn't need to compete or race against anything. There's nothing else running an air-cooled parallel twin like this that's sort of this thing. There's really nothing to stack it against in terms of performance. There's only things to stack it against in terms of style.
Well, I mean, there is still the original liquid-cooled new Bonneville, or air-cooled new Bonneville.
Is it? I think they're liquid cooled and they just have fake fins now. I'm pretty sure. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. They're at least a mixture of liquid air cooled. So here's the thing. It all just sort of snapped into place for me. So before 2006, these retro bikes were for old timers and returning riders. They can release a bike like this now at a high price point or higher price point for this kind of thing with less power, because this is for a completely different market. The W800, the W650 that was sold in 2000, whatever, was for someone over the age of 50. This is a bike for someone under the age of 35.
Yes.
So I've been sort of wrestling with this idea like, oh, like, throwback bikes are still a thing? Like, really, still? That was my first reaction. Like, really? I thought the retro bike thing was losing steam. But now, apparently, everyone's doubling down. You know? I mean, we made a list of these bikes. We've got the SV650X, the cafe racer version of that they're making a throwback bike out of that. There's the CB1100 that's been around, the Z900 RS, that's been around for a couple years now, which completely stole the thunder of the CB1000R, the XSR 700 and 900. Of course, the Guzzi V7's a throwback bike. The BMW 9RT, which people call a throwback bike, but just looks so weird to me. I don't even see the classic styling in it. Of course, Royal Enfield's doing the GT and the Interceptor, the Scout Bobber, and of course, always the omnipresent Bonneville. There are shit tons of these bikes to buy now.
Did you say Ducati Scrambler?
No, but that's on the list too. There are so many retro bikes. It's almost like retro styling isn't retro styling anymore. It's now just modern styling again. I bet there are just as many of these retro bikes out now in total, because there's loads we left off the list, I'm sure, then there are just proper sports bikes.
Potentially.
So, what the hell? And it didn't make any sense to me. Now, a little while ago, I came up with this theory of why I think people are buying these bikes. Because if you've had a few bikes, you really don't want a bike like this anymore. You kind of want to move towards more of the latest and greatest and go bigger, right? I couldn't see myself going from my Super Hawk to this W800. There's no way. It's like, right. I can't cut the horsepower in half or by more than half the torque by a third. Yeah, I can't do that. Well, it's probably half the torque again. I'm at like 80 or 71. Anyway, I can't cut the torque that much. I can't do that. So I realized the reason guys buy these bikes now, they're like, okay, I want a motorcycle. And younger people now, you know, 35 and younger, by and large, this isn't a hard and fast rule, but they don't really care about spec sheets. No one sells a car on having the most power anymore. They sell it by the look and the lifestyle and the feel and the cup holders and the entertainment system and the gas mileage. That's how cars are sold. I mean, you know, the Subaru commercials, love is what makes a Subaru. That tells you nothing about the car. Right. Not a damn thing. I mean, they sell Rexes off of performance, I guess, but that's about it. You know, I guess there are guys buying Civic Type R's on performance, but that's about it, you know? So we've got these people that are buying bikes on the feel of it. So, of course, retro sort of makes sense, but it makes more sense when you think about this. There's a radical changeover happening from a generation of riders, baby boomers and whatever, to another. And so whilst the majority of riders are still older, they're not buying bikes anymore. So the people that are buying bikes are kind of forced to come face to face a little bit with this generation that's on the exit. And because motorcycling in America is a long storied, historied thing, and there's been this idea of, oh, well, you know, $20,000 and 20 miles doesn't make you a biker bub. You better, you know, show some respect to me. And this kind of like, you don't know shit until you're 1,000 years old and ridden 6 million miles culture in motorcycling is really still sort of pervasive. So I think people buy these old bikes, one, because they do think they look cool. And yeah, old bikes do look cool. But two, I think there's this idea that there'll be some sort of built-in respect or credibility by buying a retro bike. It's sort of you're showing up and going, hey, yeah, I'm a new rider, but look, see how I like old bikes? Don't hate me. Like, I'm one of you guys.
Right.
And I think there's this idea, especially with the internet, no one wants to admit to or feel like a noob at anything. And maybe if you buy this old bike and you have retro styled gear, there's this idea that maybe some of that'll rub off. And no, like I know, like inside, I know I've just gotten into this in the last few years, but maybe inside I'll feel like, you know, inside I feel like I've been doing this forever as well because I love this so much now. And maybe this retro gear and this retro bike really helps me let people know how, like, this has kind of always felt part of me or something like that.
I'm such an old soul.
Right, exactly. And I think that's the reasoning. There's this idea that you have to somehow pay all this respect and pay these dues and whatever. And if you have an old bike, it builds some of that in. And so that made sense to me. But then I thought, well, okay, but now it's losing steam. The sort of the fad is over. And then here comes the, you know, I just realized here comes the W800 and now there's all these other bikes. I realize it's a gigantic part of the market. It's huge. And, you know, I think it was like a year ago on Cleveland Moto, you know, Phil was like, so scramblers, they're still a thing. I thought this was going to die off, but nope, we're still talking about scramblers. Well, we're still talking about retro bikes in general, and I really didn't see that still happening. So, you know, what it means to have one of these, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. I think there's just going to be this sort of retro style part of the market forever now. It's just going to be a category of bike. And I think it will lose some steam once people realize, well, okay, anyone that knows anything will be able to spot one of these a miles away as not actually a vintage motorcycle. And when people sort of get mechanically enough familiar with their bikes that they've just bought, they'll kind of see that and it'll lose a little bit of steam. But also they're going to want bikes that are more powerful and have, you know, more modern features too.
So which one of these bikes is going to turn into the PT Cruiser of its day?
Oh, the one that everyone bought that's a hand-me-down? I think that will be the Bonneville. It's the best-selling of all of them on this list.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that's been around the longest, and it's been in continuous production. It's had some updates and things. It comes in at a good price. I mean, it's not a great price, but it's a good price. Everyone respects it. Everyone thinks it's a good bike. And they've sold so many of them. We've said before that there's a market crash coming on used Bonnevilles. I don't think it'll have the uncool PT Cruiser reputation, but I think it's going to be a cheap used market bike very, very soon. I think so. I mean, if I was going to go for one of these retro bikes, I think I'd do the V7 because it's at least got, you know, the punchiest torque out of all of them. Yeah. So, you know, stoplight to stoplight, it's probably the most satisfying. And because of the history of Guzzi and all of that, and the V7's a classic model, and it never really went away. It was always around in some form, whether it was a V10, 11, you know, whatever. That's kind of the one I'd go with, just because I would just go, it'd be much easier for me to accept just, okay, 50, you know, 55 horsepower, or was it 55 torque and 45 horsepower?
51 horsepower, 45 foot-pounds of torque.
Okay. Yeah, I could kind of go that way a little easier than I could some other ways, I think. But again, I really don't see myself ever buying one of these bikes to begin with. But I don't know. So this is going to lead us into our next topic here, which is everyone's been freaking out about motorcycle culture or motorcycles declining. We haven't talked about this for quite a while. And I thought a lot of people were getting over this. And when we went to AIM, there were still, like, you know, not everybody, not every third person, but, you know, one out of five people you're talking to would just, like, sort of have this panic in their eyes about new bike sales and everything. And I thought, really? Are we still freaking out about this? Like, I know things are rocky, but we haven't hit a rock bottom necessarily. You know, people are still employed. You know, it's going to be fine. Things are slowly picking up. Like, it's going to be okay. But a lot of people still, like, panic in their eyes, right? The biggest news of AIM was, oh, the ZX6R is only $10,000 now. Hey, it's cheap. Please fucking buy this thing, right? That was the big news. And this epitome has just hit us, really, today, in fact.
Epiphany.
Yeah, epiphany. That's what I meant to say. That really what we're looking at is the fact that there's just been a hard reset on motorcycle culture. Like, a hard reset. So, yeah, old people aren't buying bikes anymore, and they're leaving the market. New people are coming in. And we also had this big economic thing that had a lot to do with it as well. So this ties into these retro bikes and them being around because, well, yeah, it's a whole bunch of people brand new to this. So whenever you're brand new into something, you're going to research it and look it up and, you know, and you don't want to seem like the noob, like we already said. And okay, so you get the retro bike. But this kind of makes a lot of sense because there's so many riders that are brand new riders right now. And so many different types of riders that were never part of the classic picture. Think about how big women in riding is now, right? I think I saw on, like, a Yami Noob video recently, in like 2008 or something, it was 7%, and now it's like 14 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really growing fast. And I think it's part of the market that's here to stay and will continue to grow. And that was never a picture of the past. And
I think the other thing is because, you know, we had this big exodus of the boomers for quite a while. You know, they kind of came back right before the recession. But a lot of them are kind of like, well, I'm just too old to ride now. I'm out. But there are a lot of new people just gradually coming in. But you have to keep in mind that there's a lot of people getting into riding who doesn't know anybody else who rides.
Yeah.
So they can't just say, well, that looks good. I'll take that. That one's blue. I like it. It's, you know, there needs to, they need some element of culture to grab onto, to pull themselves into the hobby. They need an angle and some way to fit into their lifestyle to pick something.
Right. So yeah, it's like I'm a rockabilly guy, so I'm going to pick the rockabilly throwback motorcycle. Right. And
if the hipster angle is pretty strong, but also just, you know, what's established? What was the history? What was the old culture? What is that something that, and it, you know, the angle you were talking about, that, you know, it's immediate free credibility.
Right.
Like that is something that, you know, emotionally just instantly.
Yeah, it gets the ball rolling. It moves the needle. So the story of the W800 here, I don't think is that, oh, there's another retro bike. I think the story here is this is the most obvious punctuation of this sort of 2006 to 2008 reset on motorcycle culture. And it's the perfect bike because think, it was made up to like 2006 and then stopped, and now it's come back and been made again, right?
I'm going to have to look it up.
I can't remember, but it's basically, it was killed essentially at least in the United States, with the 650, at least it was killed pre-recession, and now it's come back post. And that's really symbolic because, I said, around 2008 is really just everything just has changed since then. Like I said, you had big excess baby boomer bikes like the Honda Rune and stuff like that before 2008 happens.
Oh, they killed in 2016.
Yeah, but that was in like Australia. It was like the only place they were still selling it, you know.
Well, we only had the 2000 and 2001 W650 over here.
Exactly. Because
Americans did not get it at all at the time.
So that's what I'm saying. This is the perfect bike to highlight this changeover. So think about it. Since they've been selling to different people and now selling different kinds of motorcycles than they used to, well, also the way people consume motorcycles as a culture has changed. We've been switching from magazines to podcasts and YouTube. We don't have motorcycle clubs anymore, really. I mean, there's still a couple outlaw biker gangs, but they don't even really pretend to be part of the motorcycle culture.
They're
just straight up criminal organizations.
And the other 80% are church groups.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, if you are as likely to be in a motorcycle gang as you are, like, the Rotary Club or the Lions or something, right? Like, it is a dying thing. Like, you know, there are more Shriners than there are MC bikers, probably. Like, real hardcore 1%ers anyway, right? So, it's a dying thing. It really is. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's the reality. MC membership is way down. But what's up? People doing ride, you know, like big YouTubers will come out and just have like a big ride. Like, hey, we're all going to meet up and do this ride. That's the new motorcycle club. People going by the Misfits Garage. That's the new MC. People writing us emails. That's the new MC. It's a complete paradigm shift. Right.
Right.
And so the story of this motorcycle, the W800, I think to me just all of a sudden slapped me in the face and went, holy shit. Like, motorcycles didn't die. Motorcycles are being reborn right now. It's like I said to Emma, I think we're in another golden age of motorcycles right now and no one realizes it. But yeah. I do. I think in 20, 30 years, we're going to be talking about how radically the culture changed around this time period.
Yeah, nobody sees the glacier moving, but after the fact.
Exactly. And that's the story of this motorcycle to me, that everything that we do as motorcyclists has completely changed. I mean, think about how many more people you see on scooters here in Denver now than you used to. I mean,
oh, Todd, yeah.
15 years ago, if I saw someone on a scooter, it was like, that guy has a DUI, you know, that was the thought. Now it's like, oh, that person is engaging in a very practical form of transportation and having a little bit more fun than on a bicycle.
So even just in the last 5 years here in Denver, I've seen a huge shift where you would see nothing. 5 years ago, all the scooters were nothing but Zumas and Metropolitans. And some other Chinese scooters. And nowadays, it's radically shifted. Because now, all the Metropolitans are getting replaced by buddy scooters.
Yep.
And there's also this slowly growing niche crowd of, like, classic Vespas and Lambrettas and all sorts of super cool stuff coming back.
Yeah, I want to say, like, just a second ago when I said, like, oh, yeah, I see, you know, you see a scooterist now, and that's a person just engaging in practical transportation. I've said it before on the show. Scooters are motorcycles to me. They're completely valid as motorcycles and always have been. So just to get that in there quick, if there's, you know, I'm going to say right now, just really quick here, if anyone listening to our show rides a scooter, send me an email today. I want to know that we have scooter listeners because I really love scooters. All right, back to this paradigm shift conversation, because this is a really big thing that I think the entire industry is going through right now and no one's realizing it. I think some of the people that we perceive as being kind of ahead of the game are really behind. Like, if I think of the stuff that motorcycle.com is doing, you know, they're making these videos of, okay, we've got the new whatever bike and we're going to do this road trip on it. It's going to be a shootout and we're going to do this gear review at the same time. Well, all they're doing is taking what the motorcycle magazines used to do and putting it on YouTube. They're not embracing the format or trying to change the culture. Whereas if you take someone like Walter Riffick or Shade Tree Surgeon or Yami Noob or any one of a number of the big motorcycle YouTubers, they are doing something radically different than used to happen before 2008. They will review a bike by putting on a GoPro, getting on the bike, not preparing anything, and just tell you the raw experience of riding that bike. They will take you into a project step by step with video and show you how to do a maintenance job. You know, the motorcycle magazines could never do that. The way the meetups happen, like I said, that it, you know, some podcaster or YouTuber or whoever or blogger will announce that there's going to be this ride at this place and everyone will show up and they'll get the pictures and their autographs, whatever. And then everyone goes and rides. And there's no dues, there's no fees, there's no membership, there's no commitment. It's just, hey, I'm going to go out in the real world and, you know, touch this thing that I've only seen in video before. And it makes you feel really special and inclusive to something that, you know, millions of people enjoy.
Right.
That is very different than motorcycle culture was before. Motorcycle culture used to be, hey, it's me and I'm fucking free, man. I'm going to ride fucking naked. I don't give a shit. Right. That I know it's a cartoon version of it, but you know, that was motorcycling, was I'm born free and I'm a rebel and whatever. And now it's more, oh, I'm this, like, you know, one person, but I can be part of this larger thing. That is the feeling that I get from new riders much more than anything else. Yeah. Everyone talks about the community. You know, all the shows, all the YouTubers, all the new riders that I meet talk about this idea of a community of it rather than the single solo activity. I mean, it is still a solo activity in many ways, but there's a huge changeover that's happening. And for the first time, I'm at least recognizing how that's coming about in the way of what bikes are being sold. For so long, it was just about what's the new fastest bike? What's the new fastest bike? Again and again, year after year, even in different styles, you know, you would get to, I mean, even adventure bikes have had this arms race of performance and everything.
Yeah.
But now we're getting these bikes on the market that just don't even compete on performance. It's not even part of the conversation. I don't know when that's ever happened before in the history of automobiles in general, that the majority of the market shifted away from performance.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it has in cars, but again, that's still since like 2008.
Yeah, but you're not
watch a
you're
Ford putting... pickup truck commercial from 2005, and you've got Dennis Lyrib going, you know what? It just doesn't have torque. It has even more torque than last year. You know, he's spitting out facts and horsepower and price and this and that, and now it's like Ford, the caring pickup truck, you know, or whatever shit that they're going with, right?
Well, you're also not strapping a baby seat to the back of your new W800.
This is true. But
all right, well, you're not strapping it to the back of your R6.
Right.
You know, so you know, motorcycles have been able to get away from that for a long time because there has been this kind of passion angle of, I just want to go fast, or even if I can't go fast and I'm not going to the track, I want to know that my bike is the fastest production bike in the world.
Right.
You know, it's got that angle to it.
Yeah. Now, having said that, you know, the 47 horsepower on this Kawasaki is going to be faster than 70 to 80% of cars you're going to see around town, at least off the light. If you really just, you know, slowly let that clutch slip, keep the rear brake on, build up some revs and launch away, like, yeah, you'll get out there and you'll feel much more excited than you will in the car. It's enough. 47 is enough for a bike that's not really meant to do highway cruising and all that. It's I can't say it's slow and can't get out of its own way. It's not meant for that kind of riding.
Well, it'll do it fine at the speed limit.
Yeah. I'm sure it's a completely enjoyable Sunday afternoon bike. I'm sure it's wonderful. You're going to feel retro and cool. And if it's what you want, like, go for it. And any of these retro bikes, I have to say, if this is what the... I can't say that a whole new generation of riders starting with throwback bikes is a bad way to go. Because when I started riding, oh my God, all I wanted was a cafe racer. Until I learned very much the hard way that I did not want a cafe racer. Like, to the point that I was like hammering in fiberglass, like wrapped around pieces of tube I drilled holes in, and then put a chicken wire around and tried to, you know, compress as much as I could and hammer back into my old worn out pipes, you know, like trying to create my own exhaust and rejet and all this other nonsense and putting on slide McCoonies. And I was doing all the things and learned that no, I really just want a new bike is what I want. Yeah. And so, yeah, I can't, it would be so hypocritical of me to say that it's a stupid thing or not a worthwhile thing for new riders to lust after old bikes. So I think it's a very natural move. And I think everyone selling these old bikes is a very healthy sign of the market. And I think, like I said before, like the whole point of this is really the moment that we should all notice that motorcycling is not what it used to be.
Yeah, because at this point, you know, in 2000, you could make the claim. In 2007, you could make the claim. Maybe in 2010, 2011, you could make the claim that, oh, well, they're just going and trying to sell the baby boomers an updated version of what they were riding when they were 20.
Which is the PT Cruiser story, which right. is like the 2000 T-Bird story. It's the 2005 Mustang story.
Right. But you will not be able to, it's been another 10 years. You will not be able to make that same claim in 2019.
Oh, yeah.
Are we still just selling brand new bikes to the baby boomers?
No.
No, we're selling them to pens. Okay.
It's funny because I mentioned a couple of these theories to Dad earlier. It's like the baby boomers have all stopped riding. He's like, well, not me. I was like, yeah, but you're crazy. So as I also like you still have the time and the know-how and the tools in the garage and the space and the willingness to keep fixing these old bikes. So, you know, you're a rare bird. You need to know that. Yeah. So, I think we should take a little break here and then come back with something else. All right, and coming back in again. So, we have a real world bike review for you now. So, we've mentioned on the AIM episode, and did we mention the UPCO again on the last episode? I don't think we did.
I don't believe so.
No. So, we talked about the UPCO bike on our AIM episode coverage, and we were so impressed by that bike that Swiggy actually went and test rode one. And so we're going to tell you about that because it's basically more good news. Now, I didn't ride this thing, so I don't know. So walk us through. I want you to walk me through the experience of like the whole thing. I want to know how the sales guy presented the bike. You know, he or she must have not known what you knew about it or that you'd spoken to the CEO already and all of that. So I just want to know, like, to the total newbie walking in, how you were introduced to it, what they're trying to sell it as, and then your experience riding it.
So my first impression was pretty interesting because it was raining earlier in the day, and I was like, well, you know, I can't really just go up to Denver or to Boulder and ride this because it's like 30, 40 minutes from where I work. If I went at the end of the day, it'd be dark because it's just gets dark around 6 o'clock these days. So I had to really go on Saturday if I really wanted to test ride. And I didn't want to wait a week. So it was kind of raining out lightly. So I just said, well, fuck it. I'm just going to go anyway and roll the dice and see what happens. So as I was heading up to Boulder, about 10 minutes before I got there, it started hailing. So I show up to this little scooter store that's like the only place within 200 miles that's selling these and has them available to test ride.
I'm amazed, like, there's another one 200 miles away even.
Well, it's in like Bozeman, Montana.
Oh, okay.
That's like the next nearest one, just because it's a small company and it's so new. Like, those are the distances involved if you're not ordering direct. So I show up, it's hailing, all of their scooters are like indoors, so like the whole thing is cramped. It's like a cattle train of a 50cc and 200cc scooters inside the store. And I show up on the Guzzi. What's going on? It's like, oh yeah, I just wanted to come and check out the Upcos. He's like, okay, that kind of checks out.
Yeah. So for anyone that hasn't listened to our AIM episode, if you're a new listener, just really quickly, when we were at the AIM Expo, we saw this bike, we talked to the CEO, and it's an electric bike, two-wheel drive. And it's a utility bike. It's not really meant as a commuter thing, although they're trying to move a little bit into that area. And it's limited, so it can be sold as a scooter, which is why Swiggy went to a scooter dealer to check this thing out. So just a little reference there for what we're talking about and what we're dealing with here.
Right. So I go in and he's showing me like all around, all the stuff about it. And there were a few things I learned that I can't remember if Tim told us this or if I just forgot and this guy was telling me again. But it has ABS through software, and soon they're currently working on it. They're going to add traction control as well. So we're talking all about all the numbers on it, and you know, he was telling me about his experience riding it and riding it off road, which were very positive. So then he just, you know, it cleared up a bit, and I got to ride it around Boulder for a bit. And it was kind of magical. Okay. So I've never ridden an electric bike before. And the way I would describe just the sound of it is it's kind of, you know, if you were a well-off child, you around our age, you might have had a little electric Power Wheels car.
Oh, fuck yeah, I did.
And it's like that, but a little bit quieter. Well, it might have been a little bit louder, but through my helmet, it sounded quieter.
I you probably did not experience the sound of plastic wheels on sidewalk. That's really the signature note of the Power Wheels, let's face it.
Yeah. But it's like the same electric whine is like that kind of noise. So it's it's a really quiet ride, especially in comparison to a motorcycle.
Obviously.
Yeah. And it's an interesting feeling because you don't have to wait for the motor to rev up to start getting the torque.
Right.
So you might just about be able to, like, it's totally manageable. You can rip the throttle wide open from a standstill and it's like fine, but like it'll just kind of keep going and you can feel the torque there in that it's very high torque to begin with. It kind of starts to fall off when you hit around 20 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And it takes a bit longer to get up to 30, but it's got that kind of electric characteristic of high torque, low down, but obviously it's very capable of going way over 30 if it wasn't restricted. But what that basically means is that you can pretty much always do 30 on any public road, no matter how steep a hill you end up going on. It's just on any public road, it's pretty much always going to be able to do 30.
Cool.
The two-wheel drive was interesting.
Okay.
In that how you kind of balance your weight on a motorcycle and, you know, what you're kind of taught to do. And if you take any advanced courses and, you know, how do you manipulate the bike and what do you feel in terms of front end feel and rear grip and, you know, when you think about getting on the power out of a corner or like braking and going into a corner and like the back sliding out, like it doesn't happen. Like throw the rule book out. It's totally different, but it's very different, but it's so much simpler in a way. The only thing I felt that was kind of weird, and I think this will be updated and fixed with the traction control, is that when you like countersteer hard into a turn, and you're doing the full 30 and you like try and cut it really tight, mm-hmm. you can start to feel the front end start to lose traction a bit earlier because you've got that weight kind of off the front and you've reduced the contact patch, but it's also got power being delivered. Right. So like when it starts to go, it kind of goes pretty quickly, which is a little unnerving, but I feel like that's going to be fixed with the traction control that they're adding.
Right.
But, you know, you can just lean way forward and you could almost like just sit your belly like on the handlebars and it doesn't really matter what you're doing because it's two-wheel drive.
Right.
You can sit anywhere. You can lean forward. You can lean back. You can do whatever you want. It doesn't really affect how the bike rides, which is cool. Now, there's only two things that I felt on the bike that I didn't like.
Okay.
But these are things that you could fix yourself.
All right.
The one was that the battery was light enough that I felt like you didn't need two hand grips to pull it out. But you could just put a strap across the two handles.
Right.
And you can carry it one-handed, no problem. And that's just kind of a convenience thing, because I'm thinking, like, how I would use this in a utility sense. Well, I would want to be able to carry whatever I was carrying on the bike and take the battery in because I live in an apartment.
Right. This is an important factor for this bike. It's a larger bike. I think you could consider it more a motorcycle than a scooter, even though it's restricted to scooter speeds. But if you have a Zero and you live in an apartment, well, then you have a charging problem.
Right.
So this, you just unstrap the battery super quick and just haul it with you. And it weighs like, what, 35 pounds or something like that? 40 pounds?
It's in the like 30-pound range.
Right. So you can just carry it inside, no problem. I mean, it doesn't weigh nothing, but it's not like, oh my God, this heavy battery.
Yeah. It's no problem to carry around.
You can take it inside your workplace and charge it there. It's very easy to charge that way in that it's a smaller battery.
Yeah, it's very manageable. The other thing that maybe is a little bit more work and a bit fine, and maybe there'll be some aftermarket solution that you can rewire in, is that And this is a little, this is a really tiny thing, but kind of was like the biggest thing that annoyed me was the turn signal switch was kind of terrible.
Really?
Well, it's like a little like raid, like windshield wiper type switch that sits at the bottom of the controls under the horn. And it's at a position where it's really hard to keep a hand on the brake and flick it with your thumb. Maybe it's a lot easier if you're just not wearing gloves. Yeah. But like I feel like I would still want to ride this in all my gear. I think most scooter people wouldn't, or it'd be wearing much lighter gloves, you know, something you'd be wearing as like a farmhand.
Yeah.
But I would prefer a sturdier classic motorcycle turn signal switch.
Okay.
Well, but those are really the only two things I can take away from it.
That's very small on the complaint list.
Right.
So, right. You said you were sort of, you were impressed with enough. You're sort of vaguely considering even purchasing one of these. So for you in your life, it wouldn't be an off-road vehicle, which is weird because that's really its intended purpose.
Well, there's two things about this, maybe three things that I could, that I really kind of like about it. The first is it's nice to be able, it would be really nice to be able to like just take a very casual ride to work or to in town. And the round trips I would make on this bike on a regular basis are well within the energy, the range of the battery going flat out at the 30 miles an hour.
Right.
On top of that, it kind of feels like it would almost be a far superior bike for carrying a bunch of weight short distances, just because the center of mass of the bike is so low and it's such a casual thing to work your way around. If you had a couple of soft bags on it, or a top case, or a front and rear rack that you could bungee stuff onto.
Doesn't it have a front and rear rack standard?
I believe there are options. Well, there is like a rear rack, but you can get like a platform rack for the rear, and there's kind of a similar thing for the front. There's all sorts of options.
I thought it had like a big ruckus style rack on the front of it, like a very small basic one. Does it?
It does.
Okay, yeah. Good.
But there's like a bigger one you can bolt onto it.
Right. Well, there's an axe you can put on it.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Not since the Ural has axe been standard equipment, and now it is again.
So there's that aspect to it where, like, if I wanted to, like, it would actually be more convenient to ride it to the grocery store with a couple of soft bags, a backpack, and the front and rear rack, and do, like, 2 weeks worth of grocery shopping for myself on this bike than it would be on the Norge.
Yeah, I do want to say, like, when they were sort of advertising this bike at A, not sort of, they were full on, they had a few of these bikes there, and one was sort of decked out with their options of soft bags on it and everything, which kind of looked like soft bags you would put on a bicycle, but a bit bigger. And then they had one that was done out like fire rescue style with the axe and all sorts of tools that bolted onto it all over the place. And then they had another one, which just had the rear rack extender and a black milk crate bungeed to it. And we immediately went to that. We said, like, we love the real world honesty. And it was like the head of the American sales or head of UBCO America or whatever that was talking to us. And he's like, oh yeah, like I love, you know, real world honesty. Like we put that there very much with that exact thought in mind. It's not like we didn't have some official case to put on the back, because we sell one of those too. But we understand that people would just put a milk crate on here.
Right. So the next factor that was important to me is there's a lot of times where most of the roads are clear in the winter. And for the most part, you can ride, except that
black ice.
Well, there's black ice, but there's also like even when the roads clear up after a snowstorm here.
Like sand and salt and
There's sand and salt, but even like after a morning's worth of rush hour traffic, most of the time the roads are clear, but my apartment complex parking lot still has a quarter inch of packed snow on it.
Oh, right.
As does my office parking lot. And, you know, then you've got, you know, occasionally places with black ice and places with just lots of sand and salt on the roads. There's no chain on this to worry about getting rusted and fucked up by mag chloride. There's the two-wheel drive, potentially the traction control, and the ABS that's already there. The traction control that's coming, and the ABS that's already there that'll handle those conditions. And it's a light bike that, if I'm only going 30 miles an hour, I can bundle up a bit and ride in much colder weather. I leave on a full charge every morning and don't have to factor in a gas stop. I can get out of my snow-covered parking lot onto the road. I can handle the sand and the salt. I can handle the temperatures at those speeds. And I can handle the snow-covered parking lot when I get to work. This is a riding season extender.
You left out something else. You don't have to do any maintenance in the cold.
Right. Yeah, there's no final drive to worry about. You know, maybe at some point in a few years, like, you'd have to, like, change out the
I'm just finishing up work on my heated shed. But, you know, in the past, the prospect of spending the extra time in the cold cleaning and lubing up a chain is like, oh my God, do I really have to do that to ride today? Like, I've pushed it a couple hundred miles further than I should have, and this chain needs some attention, and it's like, I can get out and ride, but do I want to add on the extra, like, 15, 20 minutes to do this maintenance job? Or it's like, hey, I've ridden a lot this winter. Now I've got to do an oil change and I don't have a heated garage or whatever. This, you don't have to do shit to it. Just charge the battery and go. Make sure the tires are fine. That's it.
Right. So it's more riding, and especially I'm very interested to see how it sounds riding in the winter. Because I think that's going to be a very weird experience. Because it's kind of like, it's kind of like walking through the forest after, like, it's just snowed. And, like, you think about how, you know, the snow just kind of absorbs sound and makes everything quiet. So what's it going to be like going through when it's winter, when it's just snowed, everything's super quiet and the bike is quiet too?
Yeah, that's
it's gonna be
true.
A totally different experience.
I love this angle that this is a great vehicle for someone to own in an apartment where you don't have a space to necessarily do regular maintenance, or, you know, you might technically be able to do it, but if it's a project that takes more than one day, you're gonna get some shitty looks from the neighbors for having, like, tools and shit spread out all over the place, you know? It's not really a good look to be working on your vehicle in an apartment complex. It's just not. And this is just so low. I mean, you were even saying, like, it would be feasible because the bike is so light and it's electric. You could just ride it up the stairs and park it inside this apartment.
Yeah.
Well, it might be like a trick getting it back down the stairs. But, yeah, you could get it up no problem.
Well, yeah, and I also wouldn't get any shitty looks from people because it'd be completely quiet. It's not like I'm riding a two-stroke dirt bike or a trials bike up the stairs. It's like, well, I mean, it's 140 pounds. I could carry it up the stairs.
Yeah, there's probably even a lot of offices that would be totally cool with you just, like, riding it through the doors and parking it somewhere that's not obtrusive to anybody.
I could ride it through the doors into the elevator and just have it by my desk.
You would have to do that at least the first day you had it because of where you work. People would just think you were a hero. They would at least let you get away with it one day. It might be like, you know, the second or third day the boss is like, okay, so we need to talk about you parking your motorcycle at your desk. But for at least one day, everyone would think it was great.
At some point, somebody would catch on that it was a plated vehicle and be like, I don't know.
Well, you don't have to plate it.
Aren't
I'm sure it comes with a title, but it's because it's restricted.
I don't
at least
think
in
the
state you don't have to plate it. You don't have to insure it. It's moped status.
I'll have to look into it and see what it is. But yeah, people wouldn't complain right away. I think people would eventually kind of figure out what was going on. But yeah, it's something that like you could just like ride through a dog park and.
Yeah, no one would say shit.
Yeah, nobody would say shit because it wouldn't register that it wasn't a bicycle.
Well, I think it would register it's not a bicycle, but it would be more of an oddity than a nuisance to most people.
Right.
Yeah. I want to get back to what we originally said about this bike. It's not meant to replace a gas motorcycle. It is meant to do things that a gas motorcycle can't do.
Right.
And, you know, Tim, the CEO, was telling us there are people that have just put these things through the most horrendous abuse day after day after day. And the things have held up. From the stories he told me, it sounds like as a regular civilian, you can't kill this bike. It's just going to last forever. So, you know, it's a little pricey, but it's going to last so much longer than a series of scooters.
Now that I think about it, when you think about what this bike does and how it does it, it's almost like the Moon Rover. This bike could function in the vacuum of space, potentially. Yeah, you don't have to worry about, like, oh, what's going to get through the air filter and muck the motor up? What's gonna bind up the chain? What in the environment couldn't mess with the function of this bike? It's like, well, nothing but a 500-pound boulder landing on it and crushing it. Beyond recognition.
I just had this amazing moment because, you know, I always love to bring up 90s culture. So I've just combined in my head Evel Knievel's jet bike jump over Snake River Canyon with that scene in Armageddon where they jump the crater rovers over the giant canyon. I'm just imagining now Evel Knievel in a red, white, and blue spacesuit jumping an UBCO over one of like the craters on Mars.
All right, Tim, here's your marketing ploy. When Elon Musk gets SpaceX to send a manned mission to the moon, you need to come up with some sort of foldable ultralight UBCO model that the astronauts can ride on the moon.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
It's got to be less than a decade away. Just put a pin in that.
Okay. So I think we've covered that pretty good. I want to reference something here real quick for anyone that's making it to about the end of this episode. We got a cryptic email, and I'm not going to say much about that, but sort of from some sort of industry person, it was very, very cryptic. But it brought up a couple good points that I want to talk about very quickly. And it seems that there is some sort of theme going on with brothers and families and riding and stuff right now. Think about like the Motorcycle Man podcast and ours, obviously, and other things. So we've gotten a bunch of emails from families and stuff, too. If we think about, what was his name? Matt. It was Matt, right? From Alabama, who his dad, like, you know, rents the bikes and his brother rides with him, got him into bikes as well, right?
Well, you can't expect me to remember names.
I'm pretty sure it was Matt. I'm pretty dang sure. I haven't read the email for like, you know, a month or so now, at least, or whenever it was he sent it to us. Pretty sure it was Matt. And then, or was Matt his roommate that he got into writing? I can't remember, but there has been this sort of like family theme going on. And even as far as it goes, we guested on This Motorcycle Life under the theme of families that ride, right?
Right.
So I specifically want to do a call out to people talking about their families riding, because I talked earlier in this episode about this big generation and culture shift. And what's especially interesting to me about families that ride is now that there's more often than not families or brothers or father's sons, mother's daughters, father's mothers, son's mother, you know, all sorts of combinations of people riding that might be sitting on both sides of this culture shift. And what I kind of want to hear about is maybe stories from people that involve being on both sides of that, you know, sort of 2008 riding culture barrier. Because I experience it with Dad all the time. We're talking about bikes and he's sort of just really rooted in the past and not really interested in new bikes at all, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we've had him on the show twice. I'm not convinced Dad's ever listened to the show, right? You know, that's how far removed he is from the normal culture. But I am interested in how people negotiate that. So I'd like to see some emails about families, brothers, siblings, whatever, that exist on both sides of that and how that plays in. Like a great story about that is Dad rode a CB750 and came by my house the other day. And I was like, oh, you know, like the cold weather's coming. You've got other bikes you can ride. Are you about to winterize this one? Because he'd mentioned something about doing that. I was like, oh, make sure you fill it with the regular gas, not the E85. You don't want to get bullshit moisture in this tank. This is a really precious bike. You don't want to fuck it up. You mean the E10? Yeah. You don't want to put ethanol on this bike. And he's like, huh? And it just never occurred to him that that was a problem now, running a vintage bike with modern gas.
It's only probably if you let it sit.
Right. I mean, you can do it, but overall, it's not great for your bike's health. So he didn't know that. And we had to have this ongoing debate, you know, about like how he should winterize his bike. And, you know, he never really winterized bikes back in the day. It wasn't really something people thought about all that much. And so it was going back and forth. And then, you know, eventually he said, well, you know, the guy I bought it from just left gas in it for 24 years. And then I bought it and I was like,
that's why you disassembled it.
Well, yeah, you had to disassemble it and clean everything out. Also, that guy left non-ethanol gas in it for 24 years. You can do that. If you leave ethanol gas in there, it's going to turn to jelly in 6 months. Probably not 6 months, but yeah, it'll go off. But old gas without ethanol doesn't, or gas with nothing but gas in it doesn't. So, you know, that's an interesting story of how it affects me all the time. But I want to hear stuff like that from people, if we can sort of guide the emails and directions and feedback that we get. So anything else we want to tack on to this one? We're coming in at a tight, like, hour and 40 minutes. This is a short episode for us.
I don't have a lot to add right now. I think we're good.
Okay, cool. So with that, I'm going to remind everybody that they should leave us reviews on iTunes or their, I don't know, listening whatever portal thing of choice. They should send us an email at nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. And so, everybody, stay safe and stay tuned. Let's run our outro.
And I don't want to die. I just want to ride all my